Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good evening, everybody. Okay, today we will be studying Sutta number 73 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is the Mahavacchagota Sutta, the greater or longer discourse to Vacchagota. In the last class, I discussed two of the earlier suttas to Vacchagota. And so what we have here in the Majjhima Nikaya, in this series of three suttas, is it on? Okay, is a kind of series of discourses with the same wandering ascetic that constitute almost, you could say, a kind of spiritual biography of this ascetic named Vacchagota. So in the first sutta, he comes to the Buddha and asks about whether the Buddha claims to be omniscient. And here the Buddha tells him that he doesn't claim to be omniscient in the sense of knowing everything all the time in any posture on every occasion. But he claims rather to be a possessor of the called the three higher knowledges, the recollection of past lives, the divine eye which sees the passing away and rebirth of beings, and then the knowledge of complete liberation, the knowledge of the destruction of the asavas or taints. Then the second discourse is a discourse that pretty much focuses upon the state of the enlightened person after death. And then in this discourse, Vacchagota questions the Buddha, and the Buddha tries to answer Vacchagota with the similes of the fire burning, which is extinguished. When the fire is extinguished, it doesn't go anywhere. And yet the enlightened one is said to have abandoned the five aggregates at his passing away and to be deep, immeasurable, unfathomable, like the great ocean. Okay, then we come to sutta number 73, which we're going to discuss tonight. And here, apparently, Vacchagota comes to the Buddha on a later occasion. And not only in the Majjhima Nikaya, but also in the Samyutta Nikaya, there is actually quite a number of discourses to Vacchagota. There's one chapter in the Samyutta Nikaya exclusively devoted to Vacchagota. I don't remember the number of the chapter number. And then in chapter 44 in the Samyutta Nikaya, Vacchagota comes and questions the Buddha and Mahamoggallana a number of times, asking some deep questions. But here, rather strangely, Vacchagota comes to the Buddha and he says that I have had conversations with Master Gotama for a long time. It's over a long period. But now he asks a very simple, very basic question, rather than one of these deep philosophical questions. Almost, we could say, the basic, most elementary question one could ask when one comes to the Buddha's teaching. He says it would be good if Master Gotama, that's the Buddha, would teach me in brief about the wholesome and the unwholesome. That is, about what is good and what is bad. what is worthy and what is unworthy. Okay, then the Buddha says, he replies, he says, I can teach you the wholesome and the unwholesome in brief, and I can teach you the wholesome and the unwholesome at length or in detail. Still, because you've asked, he's saying, I will teach you the wholesome and the unwholesome in brief. Okay, so now he asks Vajragota to pay close attention. And then he says, paragraph 4, he says, Vajra, greed is unwholesome, non-greed is wholesome, hate is unwholesome, non-hate is wholesome, delusion is unwholesome, non-delusion is wholesome. In this way, three things are unwholesome, and the other three things are wholesome. Okay, so this saying on the wholesome and unwholesome in brief is stated by way of what familiar doctrinal category? What is the term that we use for this, these states? Tom? Well, non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion are not defilements, but there's a particular term for these three wholesome and unwholesome states. Say it again. Exactly. They're called the three unwholesome roots and the three wholesome roots. They're called roots. The Pali word used is mula, which is actually used literally for the root of a tree, the root of a plant. And so these are called the roots because these are the basic psychological forces out of which all the other defilements arise and all of the unwholesome actions. So we have greed, hatred, delusion. So sometimes unwholesome actions can arise primarily from one of the other defilements. For example, if I have some kind of arrogance, that arrogance is a state of mind. It's a defiled state of mind. And because of that arrogance, I might speak in disparaging ways to other people, in ways that hurt their feelings. And so we could say this is an unwholesome action originating from some other defilement, arrogance. But this arrogance, in turn, is rooted in greed, hatred, and delusion. Or else I might get angry, and then I speak roughly to somebody. And so this anger is a defilement. But the anger, in turn, is rooted in greed, hatred, or delusion. Okay, so the Buddha has traced all of the mental defilements back to these three unwholesome qualities, which he calls the roots. And so of the three unwholesome roots, greed, hatred, and delusion, which is the most fundamental? Delusion. Does everybody agree with him? Okay, it's delusion. So delusion is at the base of all the unwholesome roots, at the base of all the other defilements, all unwholesome actions. And what is meant by delusion is a distorted understanding of reality. And so it's because of this delusion that we see things in a distorted way, perceive in a distorted way, conceive things in a distorted way, and then out of these distorted perceptions, distorted concepts, distorted ways of thinking, there arise greed and hatred. For example, people think that it's by acquiring a lot of material goods that they can be happy. So that's a deluded idea. If I get a beautiful house, get a powerful car, have a big bank account, this is the way to be happy. And so this will motivate people so that they'll never be satisfied with what they get. This is a kind of greed. And so then one is driven always to be earning money, buying, accumulating, consuming, enjoying, but never really finding true happiness. And why is that? Because one is acting on the basis of greed arisen from distorted understanding, delusion. And then it's because of delusion that often we sort of conceive things in terms of relationships of competition, enmity, hostility, which leads to aggression, feelings of aggression, and then explodes in the form of violence. So this is hatred arising from delusion. And so greed and hatred are like the polar opposites, a little bit like the positive and negative charges of electricity. But both greed and hatred arise from delusion. And according to the Abhidhamma way of analyzing the mind, greed and hatred can never exist together at the same time, in the same state of mind. If there's greed, at the same moment, there's not hatred. If there's hatred, at the same moment, no greed. But whenever there's greed, at the same time, there's delusion. Whenever there's hatred, at the same time, delusion. So delusion is the common factor, the common root of greed and hatred. And so that's why the Buddha places the greatest emphasis on wisdom, because wisdom is what eliminates delusion. Okay, then corresponding to the three unwholesome roots, we have the three wholesome roots. These are expressed in the Buddhist text negatively as non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion, but they have positive counterparts. How would we understand a positive counterpart or a positive manifestation of non-greed? Speak. Right, giving, generosity. Some other manifestation of non-greed?
Renunciation.
Okay, renunciation. Another? I gave you the example of the person who's never satisfied with what he has, but always has to purchase more, consume more, enjoy more.
Contentment.
Contentment, exactly. Okay, then non-hatred, some positive manifestations of non-hatred. Okay, compassion is not so direct, but there's another quality related to compassion. Yeah, kindness, love is what's especially called in Buddhism metta, loving kindness. We could put compassion too. But technically, compassion is said to be the, maybe we could say compassion is the way loving kindness arises when we witness the suffering of others. But then another manifestation of non-hatred. Very important quality. Especially in day-to-day life. Sometimes people speak to you in offensive and aggressive ways. What do you have to do? Equanimity is not so direct. Ah, that's a good thought. It wasn't the word that I was thinking of. Empathy also could fit in here. It wasn't exactly what I was thinking of. There's just one word that I have in my mind. Somebody is speaking to you roughly, aggressively, in provocative ways. What do you have to do in that situation? Say it again.
Patience.
Exactly. That's what I was thinking, the one word, patience. Okay, and then non-delusion, the positive expression or manifestation of non-delusion is wisdom. Yeah, wisdom is, you say, it's the word that sums up all the other aspects. Wisdom, understanding, insight, correct knowledge. Okay, so the Buddha first explains to Vajragota what is unwholesome, what is wholesome, briefly. But now he goes on in the next paragraph to explain in detail what is unwholesome and what is wholesome. And he does this through contrasting pairs of actions. These two... There's actually 10 pairs of contrasting actions. Actions of body, actions of speech, actions of mind. Okay, so first we have three types of unwholesome and wholesome pairs of bodily actions. So killing living beings is unwholesome. Abstention from killing living beings is wholesome. Taking what is not given is unwholesome. Abstention from taking what is not given is wholesome. Misconduct in sensual pleasures, this is especially sexual enjoyment. Misconduct in sexual enjoyment is unwholesome. Abstention from misconduct in sensual pleasures is wholesome. Okay, so these three pairs are respectively unwholesome and wholesome bodily conduct. Then come four pairs which are concerned with verbal conduct. So false speech or telling a deliberate lie is unwholesome. Abstaining from false speech is wholesome. Malicious speech, that means speech which is intended to divide people who are friends. Malicious speech is unwholesome, and abstaining from malicious speech is wholesome. Harsh speech is unwholesome, abstaining from harsh speech is wholesome. Gossip is unwholesome, abstaining from gossip is wholesome. Okay, so these are four pairs of actions which originate from speech, and so they're called the four types of verbal action, unwholesome and wholesome. Then we come to three types of activities that take place in the mind. Again, unwholesome and wholesome pairs. First comes what is translated here as covetousness. In Pali, this is abhijja, which actually means the desire to acquire the possessions of others. It's not simply craving or greed, but it's craving or greed which takes the form of desiring to acquire and gain possession over things that legally and factually belong to others. So that covetousness is unwholesome, and the absence of that non-covetousness is wholesome. Then ill will is unwholesome. Ill will means more than just anger or dislike of others, but it means the arising of dislike or hatred in the form of wishing for others to undergo harm and suffering. So I might become angry with a friend or a relative, but I don't want them to undergo any kind of suffering. In that case, of course, the anger is unwholesome, but it's not the same, it's not as strong as this ill will, which is a kind of deeply rooted wish for others to undergo misery and suffering. Okay, then non-ill will, this in effect means patience, loving kindness, is wholesome. Then wrong view, and this means particularly in this context, the view that there are no consequences of our actions, that our actions don't produce karmic results. It's the view that we only live this one life. When this life is finished, everything is over, and whatever good deeds or bad deeds we do won't produce any results, any karmic consequences. And so this is considered wrong view, and its opposite is right view. Right view is the view or understanding that our actions, good and bad actions, produce their results, that they bring fruits, good and bad fruits, corresponding to the ethical nature of the action. Okay, so the Buddha begins by explaining, or after explaining the unwholesome and wholesome roots, he explains the 10 unwholesome and wholesome courses of karma. These are actions which generate karma that becomes decisive enough to take on the role of generating a new rebirth. These are the kinds of karmic actions which have a special power to bring about a new existence. So the unwholesome karma, the unwholesome actions create unwholesome karma that will lead to an unhappy form of rebirth. Whereas wholesome karma, the wholesome actions will create wholesome karma with the capacity to produce a happy or fortunate state of rebirth. But now the Buddha is going to go beyond what Vajragota asked by showing how one transcends both the 10 courses of unwholesome karma and the 10 courses of wholesome karma by gaining complete liberation from the whole cycle of birth and death. And so he says, when a bhikkhu, a monk, has abandoned craving, cut it off at the root, made it like a palm stump, done away with it, so that it is no longer subject to future arising, then that monk is an arahant, that is a worthy one, a holy one, one whose taints or defilements have been destroyed, who has completely lived the spiritual life, the holy life, who has done what had to be done, who has completed the full development of the path, laid down the burden, reached the goal, destroyed the fetters that bind one to repeated existence, and has become completely liberated through final knowledge. And so with this, the Buddha has shown the final goal of his teaching by describing the individual, the type of person who has reached the final goal. Okay, now Vajragota is going to ask an interesting series of questions. It seems to me, I have to say rather frankly, it seems to me that these questions that he's asking, they show too technical a knowledge of fine points in Buddhist doctrine to believe that they were actually asked by a wandering ascetic. It seems almost as though the compilers of the canon have put the questions in Vajragota's mouth because they imply subtle distinctions which would have been known only to doctrinal specialists. But anyway, the way the questions are presented and the answers give us an important insight into the nature of the Buddha's teaching. Okay, so first Vajragota asks, apart from Master Gotama, that's the Buddha himself, is there any one monk, your disciple, who by realizing for himself with direct knowledge here and now enters and dwells in the liberation of mind, liberation by wisdom that are taintless with the destruction of the taints? In other words, he's asking whether there are any other monks besides the Buddha who have attained the final goal of the teaching, who have completely obliterated all of the defilements and have attained perfect liberation of mind. Then the Buddha says there are not only 100 or 200, 300, 400, or 500, but there are I have far more disciples who are monks who have achieved the ultimate goal, this perfect liberation of mind. Okay, now Vajragota goes on and asks, apart from you yourself and apart from the monks, is there any one bhikkhuni that's a fully ordained Buddhist nun, your disciple, who has attained the ultimate goal of the teaching, this liberation of mind? Then the Buddha says, there are not only, there are not only 100, 2, 3, 4, 500, but far more bhikkhunis or nuns, my disciples, who have achieved this perfect liberation of mind. Okay, now he says, apart from you yourself, apart from the monks and nuns, the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, is there any one lay follower, your disciple, clothed in white? The lay disciple wears white, leading a life of celibacy, that is a life of complete abstinence from sexual enjoyment, who with the destruction of the five lower fetters will be reborn spontaneously and there attain final nibbana without ever returning from that world. Then the Buddha says there's not only 100 or 500, but far more male lay followers, my disciples, and so on, who will be reborn spontaneously and attain final nibbana there without ever returning from that world. Okay, now you see that there's a certain like technical meaning in this description. What he is referring to is the achievement of the third stage of enlightenment, or the third stage of realization. So within the early Buddhist teachings, there are four stages of enlightenment. We have the stages of, I'll put them up. Okay, this shows the four grades of noble disciples and the status in relation to being monks, nuns, or lay people. Of course, all four can be monks and nuns. But the way the questions are phrased here, we could see that the first category, the category of arahats, is restricted to monks and nuns. He doesn't ask whether there are lay people living at home who are achieve the final goal of the spiritual life. And technically, according to the Buddha's teaching, one can attain arahatship while still being a lay person. But what is said is that if one achieves arahatship as a lay person, automatically, naturally, spontaneously, one decides to go forth as a monk or nun, even that very same day. One doesn't continue as a lay person living the household life. Because to be a householder, it seems one has to have some concern for maintaining a household, and that doesn't go along with the complete elimination of all craving and all attachment. But the third stage of enlightenment, the stage of non-returner, at this stage, a lay person who achieves arhatship will spontaneously want to go forth and take ordination that same day, or else it could happen that on that day that he or she achieves arhatship, they pass away. They don't have the opportunity to go forth as a monastic. But if they do attain it and continue to live on, they'll just automatically, inherently, they have to go forth and take ordination. But now those who achieve the third stage of enlightenment, the stage of non-returner, these are described as lay people, starting with the male lay followers, who are observing celibacy. That is, what's characteristic of the third stage of enlightenment is the elimination of two fetters, sensual desire and ill will. And so because the non-returner has eliminated sensual desire, they just naturally observe celibacy. Okay, so the male lay follower who observes celibacy with the destruction of the five lower fetters, these are the fetters of view of self, doubt, clinging to mere rules and ascetic observances, and then sensual desire and ill will. The non-returner has completely eradicated those five defilements of the mind, those five fetters. And so they will no longer take rebirth into this world in which we are living, but they will take rebirth into one of the higher realms, what are called the pure abodes, in the realm of pure form. And in that realm, they'll attain complete nibbana, and they never come back into this world again. Okay, now Vajragupta goes on to ask, apart from Master Gotama, the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, the male lay followers leading lives of celibacy, is there any man lay follower clothed in white, enjoying sensual pleasures, who carries out his instruction, responds to his advice, has gone beyond doubt, become free from perplexity, gained intrepidity or confidence, and become independent of others in the teacher's dispensation, that is, in the regard to the Buddha's teaching. So this is describing a disciple who has reached the level of either a once returner or a stream enterer. These two classes of disciples are quite similar. The difference is that the once returner is due to come back to one more rebirth in the human realm, or maybe in the heavenly realm, and then reach final liberation there. Whereas the stream enterer can come back to human or heavenly rebirths up to seven more times, and then by the seventh rebirth, they'll achieve final liberation. And so the stream enterer and the once returner are alike in that they've both eradicated the first three fetters, the view of self, doubt, and clinging to mere rules and observances. And by eradicating doubt, it's said that they have gone beyond doubt and become free from perplexity. And now they have gained complete confidence in the Buddha, in his teaching, the Dhamma, and in the Noble Sangha. And so in this way, they've become independent of others. They don't need teaching even from the Buddha himself, because they now have the right view, the right wisdom that can ripen in final liberation. And we should note that it's said that the manly follower is described as one who's enjoying sense pleasures. It means to reach the stage, these two stages of enlightenment, one is not bound or one is not required to observe celibacy. Even while having sexual relations, they can still, through their practice, reach these two stages of realization. Okay, then the Buddha says that there are more than 500 followers who have reached this stage. Okay, then paragraph 11, Vachagota asks whether there is any one woman lay follower leading the life of celibacy who has reached the third stage of enlightenment. The Buddha's answer is the same as for the male follower. Paragraph 12 asks the same about the woman lay follower who is enjoying sensual pleasures, who carries out his instruction and so on, whether he has any one disciple who's reached that level. Again, the Buddha says that he has more than 500 women disciples who have reached that level. Okay, so now Vachagota has finished asking his questions. Now, paragraph 13, he sums up, this is a kind of tabulation of the results of everything that's been asked, in order to give a kind of paean of praise to the Buddha's teaching. He says, if only you yourself, if only the Buddha were perfected in this Dhamma, but none of the monks were accomplished, then this holy life would be deficient in that respect. But because you yourself, and also there are monks who are accomplished in this Dhamma, then this holy life is complete in that respect. If only you and the monks were accomplished, but there were no bhikkhunis, no nuns who were accomplished, then your teaching would be deficient in that respect. But because there are also bhikkhunis who are accomplished, the spiritual life is complete in that respect. Then he goes through each of the other classes of disciples. So, I mean, you could read that for yourself. I don't have to go through each group. But then coming to paragraph 14, he gives a very, very beautiful image to in a way to express his growing appreciation, his growing trust and confidence in the Buddha's teaching. He says it's just as the river Ganges inclines towards the sea, slopes towards the sea, flows towards the sea, and merges with the sea, so too Master Gotama's assembly with its homeless ones, the renunciants, the monks and nuns, and its householders inclines towards Nibbana, slopes towards Nibbana, flows towards Nibbana, and merges with Nibbana. So in this image, Nibbana is the ultimate goal of the whole teaching. And then we have this image of all of the Buddha's followers headed by the Buddha as being like the river Ganges flowing into the ocean. So this whole community of thousands of people who have reached, whether they're monks, nuns, male lay followers, women lay followers, they're all flowing towards Nibbana. Some of them have already merged with Nibbana, those who have reached arhatship, and the others are still flowing in that direction. And so now Vajragota is completely transformed. He's gained complete confidence in the Buddha. And so in paragraph 15, he says, "Magnificent Master Gotama, magnificent Master Gotama, you have made the Dhamma clear in many ways, as though you were turning upright what had been upside down, as though you were pointing out what was hidden, showing the right path to one who was lost, or holding up a lamp in the dark so that those with good eyesight could see forms." And now he says, "I go to Master Gotama for refuge, and to the Dhamma, and to the Sangha of Bhikkhus." Okay, so at this point, he's declared his complete allegiance and loyalty to the Buddha and to the teaching. But now he takes a step further, and he's going to ask for ordination as a monk. So he says, "I would receive the going forth under Master Gotama. I would receive the full admission or full ordination." So these are actually two stages of ordination. It seems to me maybe unlikely that a wanderer would know about the distinction of these two stages. But when one wants to become a monk, first one gets the ordination, which is called the going forth. This means one is allowed to leave the home life and enter the Buddhist community, the monastic community, as a novice. So one shaves the head, puts on monastic robes, and one observes 10 precepts. And one lives for a certain period as a novice in order to get acquainted with the monastic life and for the monks to be able to observe one to see whether one is mature enough to receive the full ordination. And so in this period, one undergoes the basic training. Then when one completes the basic training, which might last, it could be a few days, a few months, a few years, depending on one's age, one's suitability, then one will receive what is called in Pali Upasampada, which is translated here full admission. This is the full admission into the Sangha, which makes one a bhikkhu, or as a nun, a bhikkhuni. Okay, so Vajragota has asked to be admitted into the Sangha. And then the Buddha says, "One who formerly belonged to another sect," because Vajragota had been a wandering ascetic following another teacher, a non-Buddhist teacher. "So one who belonged to another sect and desires the going forth and full admission in this teaching lives on probation for 4 months. And at the end of 4 months, if the bhikkhus are satisfied with him, they give him the going forth and full admission into to the state of a bhikkhu. So this was the practice ordinarily observed if one belonged to another religious sect, another spiritual community, and one wanted to join the Buddhist order. One has to live on probation for 4 months. According to the commentary, one actually gets ordained as a novice, a samanera, observing the 10 precepts. And then for these 4 months, the monks observe one to see whether one's really gained confidence. Because it could happen sometimes somebody gets a sudden burst of faith, then they might enter the Buddhist order. If they get the full ordination, it's a very heavy responsibility. If they disrobe and go back to their original sect, then it becomes somewhat disgraceful for the Buddha Dhamma that they've lost a fully ordained disciple. And so the practice is to put the applicant on this probationary period for 4 months in order for that to test the determination, the will, the discipline of the applicant to see whether he will remain with the Buddha's teaching. Okay, but the Buddha adds at the end a sentence. He says, but I recognize individual differences in this matter. This means that the Buddha himself, because the Buddha is able to know the minds of other people very, very thoroughly. So the Buddha has the authority, if he sees a candidate and he approves of that candidate, he can say to the monks, give this one the full ordination right away. And so then the candidate doesn't have to live on probation for 4 months. Okay, but now Vajjagota says he wants to show his determination. So he says, if those who belong to another sect and want to enter your teaching have to live on probation for 4 months and then get the ordination, I'm even willing to live on probation for 4 years. He's so determined to be admitted into the Sangha that if he has to live as a probationer or a novice 4 years, he's willing to accept that condition. Okay, but the Buddha, he knew that Vajjagota was very sincere, very resolute in his decision to go forth. And so the Buddha had Vajjagota immediately admitted to the order. Okay, and then the text says, not long after his full admission, only a half month after his full admission, he's now called the Venerable Vajjagota, because he's now a monk. He went to the Buddha, paid homage, and he said to the Buddha, he said, Bhante, whatever can be attained by the knowledge of a disciple in higher training, that I have attained. So with this, what is Vajjagota saying? What is the point of this? Whatever can be attained by the knowledge or true knowledge of a disciple and higher training. The technical expression in Pali here is seka. He's saying, that I have attained. And he says, let the Blessed One teach me the Dhamma further. So what has he attained? Stream entry? Good. Right. He's reached the highest stage possible for one who is still in training. See, he can't be an arhat because he asked the Buddha, teach me further. So he still needs more guidance, but he's reached the highest level possible for one still in training. So that means he's reached the third stage of enlightenment. Okay, so now the Buddha says to him, in that case, Vaccha, develop further two things, serenity and insight. These are the two aspects of Buddhist meditation, samatha and vipassana. So vipassana is samatha is aims at the development of samadhi, that's deep concentration of mind. It's the practice by which one gathers the powers of the mind and unifies them one-pointedly on a single object in order to make the mind stable, unwavering, unified, calm, peaceful, equanimous. And then insight is the practice aiming at the development of panya, wisdom, correct knowledge, correct understanding, direct penetration of the true nature of things. And so in order to go further to reach arahatship, the Buddha is instructing Vaccagota to develop these two qualities. But the Buddha, through his power of knowledge, he knows that Vaccagota has the capacity to become something more than just an ordinary arahat. He knows that Vaccagota has the potential or capacity to also develop the six abhinyas. These are the six shantong, the six super knowledges, or the six superpowers. And so he wants Vaccagota to develop samadhi to the level of the four jhanas and probably the four formless meditations to fully master the attainments of samadhi in order that he can develop the six super knowledges. So the Buddha says, when you develop these two things, serenity and insight, they will lead to the penetration of many elements. Then the Buddha describes these many elements. So now we come to the six abhinyas, or six super knowledges. First, there is the what are called the different kinds of psychic powers or supernormal powers. Having one body, one projects many bodies and then brings the many bodies together into one. One can appear and disappear. One could move unhindered through a wall, through gates, even through a mountain. One can dive in and out of the earth. One could walk on water without sinking. One could fly cross-legged through the sky. With one's hand, one could touch the sun and moon. I advise don't touching the sun. It's too hot. And then one could, with the body, one could travel even to the Brahma world. And so one could develop that power. Then second, one can develop the divine ear by which one could hear sounds, far distant sounds, sounds of beings speaking in other world systems. All of that you can develop. Third, one can develop the ability to read the minds of other people, of other beings, knowing what their state of mind is, what their thinking. And that's described in the text in different ways. Then, as far, to whatever extent one wants, you can recollect your past lives, even back over many aeons, in great detail. And then whatever extent you want, you can use the divine eye to look out upon the world and see beings passing away and taking rebirth in accordance with their karma, their actions. So these five super knowledges, these are five mundane or worldly super knowledges. They don't really depend very much on wisdom, but they depend mostly on the power of samadhi. But then comes the sixth super knowledge. This is the knowledge of complete liberation. Okay, then the text says, to the extent that you may wish, may I, by realizing it for myself with direct knowledge, here and now enter upon and abide in the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom that are taintless with the destruction of the taints, you will attain the ability to witness any aspect of that, there being a suitable basis. Okay, so this is the instruction or the guidance the Buddha gave to Vajragotā. Okay, then Vajragotā received the instruction, paid respects to the Buddha, went off into solitude and meditated diligently, and then at a certain point he achieved the final goal. And then he knew birth, the cycle of rebirths is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done. There is no more coming back to any state of being. And he achieved arhatship. Okay, then sometime a little bit after that, a number of monks were going to see the Buddha, and Vajragotā saw them in the distance. He asked where they're going. They said they're going to see the Buddha. Then Vajragotā said to them, he said, please give a message to the Blessed One, the Buddha. Say that I pay homage with my head at your feet, and then tell him that the Blessed One has been, I think worshiped by me is not really correct. I think a better translation, has been served by me. The Sublime One has been served by me. Okay, then the monks go to the Buddha. The monks don't really understand the point that Vajragotā is trying to make, but they go to the Buddha and they deliver this message. They tell the Buddha that Vajragotā says, the Blessed One has been served by me. The Sublime One has been served by me. Then the Buddha says to the monks, he says, having encompassed his mind with my own mind, I already knew of the monk Vajragotā, that Vajragotā has attained the threefold true knowledge and has great supernormal power and might. I think by the expression supernormal power and might, he's suggesting that Vajragotā has also achieved all six of those abhinyas, of those super knowledges. And then deities also told me that Vajragotā has attained the threefold true knowledge and has great supernormal power and might. And so the Buddha understood that when Vajragotā conveyed the message, the Blessed One has been served by me, this was Vajragotā's way of telling the Buddha that I've completed the practice of the path and I've achieved arhatship. And the Buddha knows that he's achieved more than just arhatship, but he's achieved all six of the super knowledges. The three true knowledges, recollection of past lives, the divine eye and knowledge of liberation, and the other three, the supernormal powers, the divine ear, and the ability to read the minds of others. Okay, so this takes us through the end of the Vachagota Sutta. Any questions, comments? Please.
Is it possible to achieve the supernormal powers without the wisdom accompanying it? And if it is possible, what does that mean? And is it dangerous?
Okay, this is a very good, very important question. The question is whether it's possible to achieve the supernormal powers without the wisdom element, and if so, whether it is dangerous. It is actually possible to achieve them without having the wisdom, because of the six superpowers or super knowledges, the first five don't depend very much upon wisdom, but they're achieved through the power of samadhi, which means deep concentration. So somebody could have not highly developed wisdom, but through the power of meditative development, they gain deep concentration. And that deep concentration enables one to exercise these supernormal powers. And so sometimes it happens that people who are not humble get carried away by these supernormal powers, and then they misuse them. And if they misuse them, then it can be dangerous. They could use them in the service of ego rather than with a selfless purpose. So this is why the Buddha doesn't place too much emphasis on the supernormal powers as a goal to be achieved in their own right, but they should be achieved together with wisdom. And if one has the wisdom, then one will know how to use them wisely. Have I know of any people what? People born with these powers. I have heard of cases in Sri Lanka I've read of cases not only in Sri Lanka, but I've definitely know of cases in Sri Lanka of children who, as soon as they are able to start speaking, have a recollection of their immediately past life. And this usually happens in the case of children who, what happens when the child is able to start speaking, they'll say to their parents, "You are not my real parents. My real parents are living in such and such a village." They might name the village. They'll say, I used to live in a house that looked like this. There was maybe a bus going by that house. There was a well in the back of the house. They'll describe the house. And some of these cases have actually been investigated by scientific investigators and been confirmed. And usually this happens with children who, when they recollect their previous life, what happened in the previous life is that they died prematurely, usually either in childhood or in adolescence, or sometimes as a young adult. And so they didn't really have the chance to live their full life. And so it seems that somehow the consciousness has a certain strength to it that carries over into the next life. And so it will preserve the memory of the previous life. But what normally happens with children like that, once they reach maturity, that memory starts to fade away. Usually not in to my knowledge.
Have you heard of a person David Flynn?
Have I heard of a person what?
Yeah.
I haven't heard that. David Blaine. Yeah.
After that, he gained this kind of superpower. He can help with it. He levitates. He supposedly levitates.
We'll have to see him. Yeah. Does people actually see him levitate?
Yeah.
And they've tested.
I don't know what scientific rigor he's undergone. That's the
anyway, I'll look this up on Google to see whether. Yes. Can I explain it what?
Can you explain these four stages in a contemporary way, in some way that it would apply to us?
Well, I would say that these four stages are the necessary stages that anyone has to go through to gain liberation. And so I would say that through all time, these four stages are valid. There's not that they were especially suited to ancient India and not particularly suited to the United States. And so if a practitioner practices very diligently, they should be able to achieve even the first stage. But generally what we are doing, let's say, in our normal day-to-day practice is strengthening the spiritual faculties in order to gain, well, one starts by gaining the first stage of enlightenment. And so in our day-to-day practice, what we are trying to do is to strengthen, especially what I would say, the five faculties of faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. Then when those five faculties reach a certain level of strength, then one becomes sort of spiritually mature enough to make the breakthrough. And when one makes the breakthrough, then one gains the first stage, the stage of stream entry. And then from there, one carries on through the other three stages. Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Where the Buddha taught him about samatha and vipassana.
Yeah.
And yet in our contemporary world,
yeah,
at least the way I was taught, the way I entered into Buddhism,
yeah,
was the very first thing I was taught was samatha and vipassana.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if we're playing with fire a little bit by starting there.
No, I wouldn't say that. Of course, one has to begin before samatha and vipassana with sila, with ethical discipline. But what I would assume is that, you see, the way of presenting the suttas, of preserving and presenting, it's very concise and very compressed. And so certainly, in order to become a non-returner, Vajragota had to be practicing samatha and vipassana. Those are the sort of necessary requirements for all the stages of realization. And so if you look at sutta number 6 in the Majjhima Nikaya, it's called the Sutta Akankeya Sutta. That sutta will speak about how to reach any of these stages, starting from stream entry, once returner, non-returner, arhatship. One needs ethical discipline. Let's just see. Okay, on page 116. Starting with paragraph 11. If one should wish, may I with the destruction of three fetters become a stream enterer. Then it goes on, paragraph 12, may I with the destruction of three fetters and the attenuation of lust, hate, and delusion become a once returner. Then 13, may I with the destruction of the five lower fetters become a non-returner. Then ending with paragraph 19, may I attain that taintless liberation, deliverance of mind, deliverance by wisdom, In each case, let him fulfill the precepts, be devoted to internal serenity of mind, that's samatha, not neglect meditation, that's jhana, and be possessed of insight, that's vipassana. And so definitely to reach any of the stages, samatha and vipassana are both necessary. So it seems that the Buddha must have given a more elaborate explanation to Vachagota on how to develop samatha and vipassana in the way that would be particularly suited to him, for him to progress further.
And if I could just follow up, since you referred us to that sutta number 6.
Yeah.
I noticed, though, that it's, those were all addressed to bhikkhus.
Yeah.
Still also apply as guidelines to lay
people. I would say definitely so, because, as I said, the first three stages are not in any way confined to bhikkhus, but they're open to anybody. Okay.
You mentioned how once you attain stream entry or once return, you have confirmed confidence.
Yeah.
In rebirth, in karma, and all these things that we really cannot confirm.
Yeah. I would say that, okay, what is said, one has confirmed confidence, and one has confirmed confidence in the Buddha, confidence in the Dhamma, and confidence in the Sangha, in the sense of the Sangha of noble ones. Okay, so one has, what the stream enterer does is to make the breakthrough to the truth of the Buddha's teaching. He hasn't actually fully developed the understanding of that truth to the point of uprooting greed, hatred, and delusion. But he's seen the essence of the teaching, the essential point. And so with that, he's seen basically the same thing that the Buddha himself has seen. So he has what I call confirmed confidence in the Buddha, in that he's experienced the truth of the teaching. And so he could place trust in the Buddha based on that breakthrough to the truth of the Dhamma. So that's the confirmed confidence in the Buddha. Now he's seen the Dhamma himself, so he has confirmed confidence in the truth of the Dhamma, though he doesn't necessarily see all the different aspects of the teaching of the Dhamma, but he's seen the essential truth, which would be the three characteristics, dependent origination, and the Four Noble Truths. And then, because he's seen the truth of the Dhamma, he knows that there are other people who have practiced the same path, and by practicing it, have also seen the truth. So that's the basis of his confidence in the Aryan Sangha, the community of noble ones.
And so the unverifiable concepts of karma and rebirth can still remain just as concepts at
I would say definitely, yeah, yeah. It doesn't mean that he's actually seen the working of karma and rebirth. For that, one would have to develop this divine eye to actually see the workings of karma and rebirth. Okay, it's 8:20, so I think we'll have to end for the evening. The next class that we'll have will be on December 15th. That's 2 weeks from tonight. And that will be, we'll take sutta number 74. This is the Diganaka Sutta. It's short, so it will be a challenge for me to fill out in the evening. But I think there'll be material to speak about. Okay, so thank you all for your attention. And we'll end with the sharing of the merits. So we share the blessings or merits of speaking on Dhamma, discussing the Dhamma, with the deities, the different spirit beings, and with all beings in the world. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanang. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanang. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mang parang. Etavatacham hehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe devanumodantu sabasampati siddhya. Etavatacham hehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhutanumodantu sabasampati siddhya. Etavatacham hehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe satanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.